Crowds chant to the president, build the wall. The president spoke in private about not wanting to let people in from less desirable countries. The term he used was more explicit. The words change, but this is a tune we've heard before in the United States. A country where the majority of the population is descended from people who lived in Europe hundreds of years ago has its issues with immigration. Xenophobia, the fear of foreigners, waxes and wanes in the country. It has waxed of late. Erica Lee tracks the whole historical record in her book, America for Americans, A History of Xenophobia in the United States. Erica Lee is a professor at the University of Minnesota and the chair of immigration history. She's also the director of the Immigration History Research Center at the university. And Erica is the author of three previous books, all on immigration. Erica Lee, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can I guess the earlier books predate the Build the Wall, Ban All Muslims period in American history?
They do, but in fact, the debates that we've had as a nation around immigration have always informed my writing. So I talked about Chinese exclusion and the history of our laws banning the first group to be singled out for exclusion beginning in the 1880s. And then I also looked at the history of immigration detention by focusing on the Angel Island Immigration Station, which is south of you in San Francisco. So these questions have been part of our society, part of our politics, and certainly part of our history long before Donald Trump became president.
But, you know, there's a moment early in the book where you describe a collision of things going on in the world at large and in your own personal world. You were visiting Ellis Island, I guess, in the summer of 2016?
I was, yes. I was just being a tourist and wanted to see some of the new exhibits and really was struck by this sort of disconnect that I felt standing in line and watching all of the other tourists line up and talk about their own personal histories to Ellis Island and sort of just that joyous patriotism that many felt as we were passing the Statue of Liberty and then going to embark on this National Historic Landmark that has symbolized America's welcome to immigration. But as I was experiencing all of this, the 2016 Republican National Convention had just wrapped up. And so I was also listening to news reports and to some of the speeches. And I was just trying to reconcile, how did these two Americas fit together? How is it that we have built our national identity on this idea of the nation of immigrants, but yet this, mainstream political party, perhaps headed towards success, didn't know it at the time, has really made xenophobia, fear and hatred of foreigners, a central part of their message, just unabashedly, totally not polite, but very strident and certainly getting a great response.
But Erica, even knowing the deep history of xenophobia in America, did that mood catch you by surprise?
It did. It really did. I think because as a historian and as a professor, I teach this history, certainly, and the way in which we've written American history has definitely exposed and revealed some of those darker chapters that I certainly didn't learn about as a high school student and more so as a college student. So we know about these, one could say these ugly chapters of deep racism affecting so many groups. But along with the history writing, historians have often exposed or promoted this idea, this message that, but we've learned from our mistakes. We are moving towards a better future, one in which we will uphold the ideals, the democratic values that perhaps previous generations had not. And this was very much the message of President Obama. And so I think as an American, exposed to these ideas and wanting certainly to believe in them, but also as a member of a profession that has helped to promote this idea that we are moving forward. I think when I was, working with my students to understand the debates over immigration with the refugee crisis in Europe in 2015 and then Donald Trump's candidacy, you know, much of the conversation in our in my classroom was, what's going on? You know, is this an aberration? Should we just be laughing him off, or, you know, thinking of him as an extreme version of this, you know, darker history? Or could this really be happening? Are we, you know, really moving into a new era of American history? And if we are, is it so new? Is it such a break from what we've had before? That was the, you know, main question that I wanted to answer in this book after the 2016 elections.
Now, the spikes in xenophobia that we've seen through American history, have they usually been a response to events in the world, in the events domestically anyway?
Not necessarily. You know, so there is this idea that xenophobia waxes and wanes, rises and falls, ebbs and flows. And to be sure, there are certain times when we scapegoat immigrants during war, during economic recession, during other times of anxiety. But one of the things I really wanted to suggest in the book is that this is a deeply embedded tradition, that our hatred, our hostility of immigrants can happen and has happened during times of peace and war, economic recession and economic prosperity, during times of racial progress and racial struggle. And so I think we see this through various chapters. When, for example, the United States passes the Chinese Exclusion Act in the 1880s, one would think from the debates in Congress and from the political rhetoric and all of the speeches and the riots and the mass expulsions of Chinese in the West, one would think that the numbers of Chinese coming in were so great that they were just flooding into the country and taking over everything, where in fact they were a fraction, you know, 1%, less than 1% of the immigrants coming in.
All right.
That's the conundrum, you know, that I think is helpful to think about when we're trying to make sense of what's going on today.
We should explain the title of the book. This is this echoes earlier uses of the phrase, which are more than one, you point out, Erica.
It is, yeah. You know, one might recognize the title or the phrase from contemporary times, but in fact, when I looked through the archives, there are a number of American politicians and others who have used it. Unfortunately, it's always been a message of exclusion. The idea of who is really American has been scripted to mean white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. So, you know, some of the first to use it were members of the so-called American Party, or some of the listeners might know that better as the Know Nothing Party. They were the anti-Catholic, specifically anti-Irish Catholic political party that came of age in the 1850s, and this was one of their rallying cries. And then later presidents like President Roosevelt used it to describe the need for European immigrants to really shed all aspects of their foreign culture and become, you know, truly assimilated. And eugenicist Madison Grant used it to describe the need for very, very strict immigration restrictions that would eventually close the doors to all Asians and also greatly shut it against immigration from Southern, Eastern, and Central Europe.
So you actually begin the book a bit further back in time than the Know Nothing Party, actually about a century and something earlier, 1710s. Who were the targets at that time?
Yeah, this is one of the most surprising things that I always share with my students, and that is I simply share some of the speeches and some of the words, you know, that there's a group of swarthy immigrants who are coming into the colonies, who are not learning English, whose strange and foreign ways might overtake our English ones. And then I ask them, who do you think they're talking about? Who are these swarthy immigrants who are, you know, so un-American and who are considered an invasion? And they're like, ah, you know, it's the Irish. I'm like, no, a little bit too early for that. You know, it's the Germans. It's Benjamin Franklin writing in his private papers about this, you know, group of people who he considered a grave threat to the colonies, especially to Pennsylvania, where he's writing from. And some of our first immigration regulations are really targeting German immigrants.
So how fervently did he feel about this? He didn't actually want to remove Germans from the country, is that right?
No, that's right. And that's what's one of the most, I think, helpful things to think about, is that our fear and hatred of immigrants has been uneven. You know, we have complained about certain groups. We have established some regulation, but it has varied. You know, so European immigration has never been completely barred, but Asian immigration has. Muslim immigration has. Even at the U.S.-Mexico border, Mexicans had not been the ones who were the focus of some of the country's first border patrol officers. It was actually Chinese who were coming in without authorization. And so we see this with Germans and Irish, that yes, there's some hateful rhetoric. There's some limited regulations. There's even, when we get to the Irish Catholics, some brutal racial violence and riots. But the attempts were never to restrict immigration, merely to, or, and perhaps merely is not the right word, but certainly with the Know Nothing Party, they were... they wanted to assure that immigrants didn't gain the upper hand, especially Catholic immigrants, the upper hand in American politics. So they privileged white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in terms of who could hold office, and they wanted to limit the naturalization or delay the naturalization of Catholic immigrants.
Erica Lee is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is America for Americans, A History of Xenophobia in the United States. Interesting to look at, as you go further into the descriptions of the Know Nothing Party, they preached against politics as usual, as in the system isn't working for us?
That's right. Yeah. They had a number of issues that they were railing against, which makes them such a fascinating political party. In the North, they were vehemently anti-slavery. In the South, they were pro-slavery, so they reflected the divisions in the country over slavery. But they also promoted the idea that they were for the working man. And so some of their scapegoating as immigrants was specifically relied on the message, you know, do you want to know why you're poor? It's because of the immigrants. It's because of the immigrants who are taking over, rather than the, you know, newly industrializing businesses. And they also thought that the Whig Party, which predated the Republicans and the Democrats, that that two-party political system was corrupt. And so they were an independent new political party. They had a brief run, but they were very successful in some states, but then by 1856, they were essentially disbanded, and the new Republican Party took over.
Now, interesting too that at some point in the 19th century, that the term Native Americans arose, and we didn't mean it like we mean Native Americans now.
Yeah, and this is also part of that history from the Know Nothing. Native American meaning small n, meaning born in the United States. Part of this campaign to kind of affirm the political power of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants was to claim that we are the real Native Americans. Native Americans in opposition to these new foreigners who are coming in, who, if we don't stop them, could numerically take over from us, but also indigenous peoples as well. You know, 1850s is a time period when we're debating immigration, debating slavery, but also engaging in forced removal, Indian wars, westward expansion. It's all mixed together. And this term, Native American, sort of took that Native status, indigenous status, away from real Native Americans, and they claimed it for themselves.
Were there enough of the WASPy people, the people who called themselves Native Americans, to do the work of a country that A, was growing, B, was undergoing the Industrial Revolution?
That's an excellent question, and that's part of the reason why the party ultimately failed is because, again, they never called for restriction of immigration. And by the time Abraham Lincoln became the Republican Party's nominee and then president, he actually walks back and publicly disavows the xenophobia and nativism of the Know Nothing Party, and says, you know, we actually need to promote immigration. And that period lasted for a few decades until a new immigrant menace, the Chinese on the West Coast, became the subject of debate and then the passage of federal laws.
So I'm curious. It is interesting to look at how, through American history, the idea of bringing people into the country because industry needed workers reminds us, for example, of the Bracero program closer to our own time. I mean, through the course of American history, has big business ever just come right out and said loudly, "We need foreign workers, let them in," or is it something spoken more softly?
It has depended on the industry, and it has depended on the time. Up until recently, and including today, you know, some of the opponents of President Trump's policies have been big corporations. Certainly, when the administration was just beginning to institute some of its policies early on in the after inauguration, a great variety of corporations, from Nike to Google to Starbucks, you know, all protested against the policies, not only on corporate reasons, but also humanitarian reasons. Back in the 19th century, early 20th century, railroads, for example, were, as you say, perhaps more soft. They really depended on the exploitation of immigrant labor and of U.S.-born labor, and helped to promote xenophobic policies when it served their interests. So when there might have been a surplus of workers or other times. So it's a mixed history, certainly, with big business.
Erica Lee is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a historian of immigration. She runs the Immigration History Research Center at the University of Minnesota, has written several books. Her latest is called America for Americans, A History of Xenophobia in the United States. You're welcome to join the conversation here on the Exchange. Weigh in with your thoughts or questions about immigration through history. 800-838-3760 is our phone number. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Becca in Lane County dropped off a comment via email. She says, Donald Trump and I have different reasons to limit immigration. His is xenophobia. Mine is not really wanting more human bodies here with all their demands on the environment. That's one comment. John in Grants Pass dropped a question off, too. He wants to know if you can compare our xenophobic tendencies to other countries like in the EU, where there seems to be a fear of Syrians and Turks.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think that there's a general way in which xenophobia works, and that is, you know, identifying who the foreigner is. That could be through racial grounds, could be through religious grounds, could be through class and gender and sexuality, and also national origin. I think that all of those categories work together to define certain groups as more threatening than others. I think in Europe, it tends to be more focused on religion and national origin. Race works in different ways there than it does here, and certainly is not as part of the public discourse as much as in the United States. And of course, in the United States, we have histories of empire, similar to the EU, but also native dispossession and slavery. And so there's similarities, but also important differences as well.
We've been talking about this in general sort of terms, but the fact is there was actual physical violence. There were anti-Catholic feelings in the 19th century, anti-Chinese pogroms like the one in San Francisco in 1877. We've also talked on this program before about 34 Chinese miners killed in Oregon in 1887. The Northwest appears to have been a bit of a hotbed of atrocities against Chinese people.
It does, and I talk in in great detail about the forced expulsions of Chinese in Tacoma and in Seattle in 1885 and 1886. So this is part of a period that some historians call the driving out of Chinese from the far west. And I do think it's a mixture of factors that occurred there. Part is the long history of westward expansion and conquest, and also the expectation and the idea that Pacific Coast states like California, Oregon, Washington were supposed to be a haven against slavery, a haven against some of the race problems that Americans thought were dividing the country. And while there were fewer African Americans, certainly there were many Native peoples and then growing numbers of Asian immigrants. And so I think there was this sense that we thought we were escaping, you know, these race problems, but actually we have our own. And before we can get Congress to act on our behalf or in conjunction with Congress's passage of Asian Exclusion Laws, we're also going to take things into our own hands and resort to this violence.
Erica Lee's our guest. Her book is America for Americans. It's interesting, though, that the Chinese Exclusion Act was repealed during World War II. What was going on there?
So foreign relations has always impacted our domestic relations. When we're passing the Exclusion Act in 1882, the United States has very little respect towards China. It's a crumbling empire with lots of problems of its own. It's very easy to pass a law that is so explicit in its disrespect and in its racism, called the Chinese Exclusion Act. But by World War II, we're fighting alongside China in the war in the Pacific. And it becomes increasingly embarrassing and just not politically expedient or diplomatically expedient to, on the one hand, say, we are fighting on your side with you, China, but we just don't want any of your people to come into our country. It also has a great resonance to the international message that the United States is also sending, right? We are part of the Allied effort to fight fascism and Nazism around the world, and certainly during the Cold War, we're fighting communism. We are the good guys. We're the ones who believe in democracy and freedom. But we have these racist immigration laws that not only barred Chinese, but also other Asians, and let only small numbers of immigrants from Southern, Eastern, and Europe into the country. So it tends to be more of a diplomatic international decision rather than a, you know, pure-hearted humanitarian or civil rights motive.
Let's talk about opposition to people coming from Europe, though, because it's interesting that descendants of Western Europe tried to block people coming from Southern and Eastern Europe, and these are people who often could claim lineage back to the Mayflower. Every time I hear about this, I think the Mayflower must have been a really big ship.
Yes, so by the 1920s, this is another way in which our xenophobic history sort of builds on each other. So we have this tendency to compare, right, one group against the other. So it was actually quite common by the late 19th century, early 20th century, when Southern Eastern European immigrants are coming in great numbers, really record numbers, it was common to say, now, these aren't the right kind. They're not like us, meaning those of us from Northern and Western Europe. They're more like the Chinese, who we've already barred, and some, like the Italians, may even be closer to African Americans. And so there's this science and also popular rhetoric of dividing people and categorizing people and placing them in a hierarchy so that there is a very common understanding that people from Italy, Greece, Poland, Hungary are less than, that they actually have genetic deficiencies as compared to people from England, France, Scandinavia. They, of course, have more abilities than African-Americans, Native Americans, and Asians, but they are considered racial inferiors, and that if too many came, the argument goes, that they would take over the country, that they would be so prolific that they would actually, you know, their birth rates would overtake those of the Native Americans.
So we pick up at the early 20th century, where we have the likes of the Immigration Restriction League of Western and Northern Europeans trying to block Southern and Eastern Europeans from coming in because they're less than. Some big political names got behind this effort, Erica. Can you give us a sample?
Yes, absolutely. Henry Cabot Lodge, a well-known senator from Massachusetts, goes to war with his colleague, another senator from Massachusetts, Joseph Kennedy, of course, the grandfather of our president, JFK. And they are battling over what would become racial quotas, quotas that the U.S. Congress passed in 1921 and 1924. We're getting up at the 100th anniversary of those two laws. Racial quotas that set a bar on how many Southern, Eastern European immigrants could come in, and also barred Asians exclusively. So just for example, Italy had been sending many thousands of immigrants per year from the 1890s up through the 1920s. 224,000 came in 1921, but then these racial quotas were put into place, and they were given a quota of just over 3,800. So a great reduction in immigration. But of course, Asians were barred totally. So you can see that how the racial hierarchy is mapped onto immigration laws in this time period. And those would stay in place until 1965.
Wow, that was a long time that Immigration Act was in effect. Now, I want to point out that also in the 20s when this passed, we had a situation I was just reading about independently over the weekend about the Palmer raids of the 1920s, which rounded up people who were suspected of wanting to conspire against the government and deporting them. So Ellis Island, I did not realize, was actually turned into a jail for a time.
Absolutely. You know, both detention centers on the East and West Coast are not just processing immigrants coming in, but are immigration jails to keep those who have been arrested, who are either, you know, waiting to hear whether they're going to be let into the country, but also those who have been arrested and who are slated for deportation.
Wow. So there was a much larger effort that ended up running up against the rocks, as I understand it, because immigration was under the control of the labor secretary at that time, and he blocked a lot of the efforts of the likes of the up and coming J. Edgar Hoover.
Yes, absolutely. And this is one of the ways in which, you know, I was mentioning some of the factors that go into how we target certain foreigners, but political beliefs, you know, so those who are believed to be anarchists or those who are believed to be communists or who have expressed certain political opinions during that time period were slated for deportation, considered dangerous to the United States.
Now, you pointed out how sharply immigration fell after the 1924 Act was put into place. Attention turned to Mexico at that point. What made it suddenly a target?
During the Great Depression, there are calls to get rid of the Mexican. And this is one of the really interesting turnarounds that we see in immigration history. So in the 1920s, we've barred Asians. We've greatly reduced European immigrants. Places in the Southwest and the Far West, up in the Pacific Northwest, they're turning to any kind of labor that they can get. And this is where we see the increase of Mexican migrant labor. And so many farmers and railroad barons, they are promoting, they're facilitating, they are literally, you know, recruiting Mexican migrants to come north. And the rhetoric around them is that they're actually the ideal immigrant. They'll work at whatever. They'll do whatever we tell them to do. They're not striking like the European immigrants. And they naturally want to go home when it's a downturn. You know, so they'll come when we want them, and they'll leave when we don't. But after many decades, some decided to stay. And during the Great Depression, there's a strain on resources, of course, and many, many families are suffering. There's that turn towards nativism. Well, we should take care of our own first, even though many of these Mexican-American families had U.S. citizen children, had been here for decades, actually had been in places like Southern California longer than some of the newer arrivals, say from Oklahoma. But there's a concerted effort to bring U.S. immigration officials out to scare Mexicans home. And so there were ads placed in newspapers talking about how, you know, we're going to round up those of you who may not come in without proper documentation, even though your employer recruited you. And there were massive raids and then more scare tactics to convince needy Mexican-American families that no more aid would be coming to them. And if they sought it, they would be deported. And so you should just return home on your own.
There were even some people, it's interesting, I had never seen these pictures before of the trains that were taking people to Mexico from Los Angeles in the 30s. Tell us about that.
This is a very organized effort of many deportation trains that were organized by social relief workers in conjunction with the Southern Pacific Railroad to bring hundreds of people. Some of them had, you know, over 800 people, many of them young children who were citizens by birth. They were falsely told that they could return if they wanted to, but many were really essentially banished to Mexico. And during this time period, 20% of the Mexican origin population in LA was essentially removed and forcibly repatriated to Mexico.
Wow. Let's move on and talk about feelings about Japanese Americans, which apparently had this sentiment had begun to rise 20 years plus before Pearl Harbor. Who was Senator James Phelan, and how did he make this a big issue?
So this, again, is a mixture of just, you know, straight out racism combined with what happens when the U.S. goes to war with Japan. After the Chinese were excluded, many U.S. farmers and businesses still needed laborers, and so they started turning to Japan, Korea, the Philippines, then Mexico. So Japanese immigration increases quite a bit in the early 20th century. But as Japanese Americans stay, as they start establishing farms, as they start establishing businesses, there's economic resentment, but also, again, sort of that fear of an Asian invasion displacing whites becomes more prevalent. And this idea that the Japanese are just like the Chinese. We should take care of them just like we did the Chinese. So there are many state laws that get passed to try and limit Japanese Americans' economic prosperity. They're barred from naturalization, just like Chinese. And then when Pearl Harbor happens, there's a mixture of this deep-rooted racism, but also this longstanding fear that Japanese Americans have never really been interested in the United States. They've always been more loyal to the Japanese Empire and thus are a threat in the making to our national security.
And among the pictures in the book that'll blow your mind, there are things like advertisements for laundry soap that'll clean up America by kicking Chinese out. I'd seen that one a couple of days actually before I read the book. But then there's the Dr. Seuss picture of Japanese picture people looking across Japanese Americans using telescopes to look across the ocean for their orders from Japan. So everybody got into this. I do want to talk about after World War II, though. You point out that civil rights legislation ended up intersecting with immigration. So we had the 64 Civil Rights Act, 65 Voting Rights Act, and this also had an effect on the 1924 Immigration Act. What happened?
Yeah, so again, one of the challenges is when you're moving towards an era of racial progress and civil rights, you start looking at the laws that are already on the books, and it's very clear that those quota laws, those racial quota laws, as well as the Asian exclusion laws, go against this new commitment to civil rights. And so in 1964 and 1965, President Johnson really takes on the mantle of immigration reform. This had been a key issue of JFK before he was assassinated, and he makes it very clear this is a high priority for the Johnson administration. The problem is that while there's much support for formally ending discrimination in immigration laws, and especially ending those racial quotas that affected so many European Americans, it's very clear that Congress only wants to go so far. And it's not even a case of open borders versus ending these racial quotas. It's still more about, okay, let's abolish these national origins quotas, but we still want to somehow engineer our immigration so that it tilts towards Europe. We don't care so much about those coming from Italy or Poland or Greece anymore. They have shown that they can be safely assimilated. But what we don't want to do is open up the gates to the floods from Asia, from communist oriental countries, the hordes from Africa or from Latin America. But in the end, the law does many things. It does end discrimination formally in immigration law, but it also places the first ever restrictions, numerical restrictions on immigration from Latin America, especially from Mexico. And this is where you get into the contemporary problem, which is we have placed great restrictions on immigration from Mexico, but our country has still needed or relied upon Mexican migrant labor, which continues after 1965, but they have to come now illegally.
Erica, I guess one of the more striking statements of many in the book is your statement in the introduction that xenophobia has become normalized. How do you see that? Do we accept that? Do we expect it?
I think so, because there have been many times when I've talked in public about this topic, and people will come up to me and say, but isn't this just human nature? That we just fear what's different. We fear the foreigner. Is there really anything that we can do about it? And also when I rattle off, some of the common arguments, people nod their heads. We've heard it before. Immigrants take away jobs. They don't want to assimilate. There's too many of them. They bring crime into, we know this playbook. We've heard it before. And so I think once something becomes part of our memory, part of our worldview, it becomes normalized. It becomes easier to accept. It becomes easier to think, this we don't like what's happening. We don't like these policies. But we'll return to normal if we just elect a different president. And I'm not so sure anymore. I think I used to think that. I'm not so sure anymore that's really going to solve all of the problems.
And you do see xenophobia ultimately threatening democracy, you say?
I do. If you look at polls, even today, you'll see that most Americans do not support the policies that President Trump has put forward. Most Americans want some sort of legalization for the so-called Dreamers. They don't support the wall. Yet somehow our government, our country, based on apparently minority opinion, is putting forward these policies.
Erica Lee runs the Immigration History Research Center at the University of Minnesota, where she's a professor and the chair of immigration history. She's written three books before this one. This one is called America for Americans, A History of Xenophobia in the United States. And we just gave a cursory examination of it. There's a lot more to talk about, just not today. Erica Lee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure.